I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this May 30th, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can check our podcasts out at iTunes. We're under College Radio. Barbara's website is penonfire.com. There are direct downloads as well as archives of all of our past shows up there. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined now by Jesse Katz, and coming up in the second half of the show, New York Times bestselling author and baby name expert Patricia Redmond will be here talking about her latest novel, The Possibility of You. Jesse Katz has written for the LA Magazine, the LA Times. His writing has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, Details, Texas Monthly, Food and Wine, Men's Health. It goes on and on. He has also been anthologized in Best American Magazine Writing and Best American Crime Writing. He teaches from time to time the literary journalism program right here at UCI and has volunteered at both Central Juvenile Hall and other correctional facilities as a nonprofit called Inside Out Writers. His journalistic work has twice been awarded the Pulitzer. He is the recipient of a Penn Award for Literary Journalism. And if that wasn't all enough, his memoir, The Opposite Field, came out a couple of years ago. It was published by Crown. So we have a lot to talk about this morning. Jesse, welcome.
Good morning, Marie. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you on. In full disclosure, I will tell our listeners that I met you through my husband's law firm. I haven't actually met you, but I hope to meet you through his law firm, where you work not as a lawyer but as sort of a writing coach. Yeah, helping writers write better.
This is true. I have kind of an exotic position at O'Melveny & Myers. I think we're the first law firm, major law firm in the country to have an in-house editor. So I wear a variety of hats. I do try to help lawyers become better writers, but I also lay hands on their work and help shape and mold briefs and motions that are going first to a client and ultimately to a judge.
That's no easy task. In my former life, when I met my husband, we were both lawyers, and breaking yourself of the habits. I was in corporate law, so I was doing more contractual work than legal briefs. But breaking yourself of the habits of, writing creatively. I remember taking my first contract into the partner, and and she's like, this isn't a creative writing class, Marie. This is a contract. So breaking myself of legalese to go into fiction was no easy feat, I have to say.
It's funny. They deliberately hired somebody who didn't have a legal background. Unless you count the time that I covered street gangs for the LA Times in the early 90s, I don't really have any mooring in the world of law. And I think the firm was quite enlightened to consider somebody and actually choose me from a group of candidates where others did have a legal background, precisely because they wanted somebody who wasn't immersed in that in that style and that voice and that legalese that kind of creeps into everything.
Right, that horrible training. Are the rules that apply to make a story compelling the same rules that apply to make a legal brief compelling or a motion compelling?
Wow. Yes and no. I think there's... Turning nonfiction into something compelling is an art, and it's an art whether you're doing it for a newspaper or a magazine, or you're doing it for the court. You're still bound by the facts. You're still tethered to the law. There's certain things that you can't make up or alter for your convenience. And yet you have to extract something from that. You have to find a narrative or a story that is, conducive to your client's position.
Yeah.
And I find that a lot of the stuff I grapple with here is lawyers who want to put it all on the page. They see the world and the law as this very kind of treacherous place with lots of twists and turns and nuances, and they want to make sure they have sort of acknowledged every possibility and variation and iteration of something, and that's not what a story is. you have to cut through that and find the through line that is going to engage the reader and guide them through your position.
Right. Yeah, I'm intrigued by this notion of working with prisoners and working with lawyers, and not that there's any... Not there's any similarity there, but and working with UCI students all over the place, and what the are there more commonalities in people's approaches to writing from these very three different perspectives, or do they all bring their own unique sort of sets of issues to the table?
Well, I think the thing that is the common struggle is to sort of free yourself to say something honest, to really say what you mean, what you think and you feel. I think it's the mechanics of writing are so cumbersome and elusive, and the lawyers are better than I think with that than maybe the students, and the students are better than that with that than the prisoners. but everyone, I think, struggles somewhat with the assembly work, and I can say this because I do the same thing. I've many times turned in a story where I've spent so much time kind of erecting it and making sure, you know, the nuts and bolts are all screwed together and the joints are as they should be, and you know, it's not going to keel over, and yet sometimes lose sight of what the story is, of what I'm really trying to communicate. And I think, in my experience, pretty much all writers, wherever they are, deal with that issue.
No kidding. My guest this morning is Jesse Katz, and he is the author of the memoir, The Opposite Field, and an award-winning journalist. Let's turn for a little bit to the memoir. Tell us, well, I'll let you introduce sort of the subject matter and the inspiration for writing it first, and then we'll jump off from there.
Okay, sure. You know, I wrote a book called The Opposite Field, and it is a memoir. It's entirely nonfiction. Not a single name or place has been altered or embellished, for better or worse. And it's set in the immigrant suburbia of Monterey Park in the San Gabriel Valley. And it covers a lot of ground. It's about parenthood. It's about raising the son. In my case, it's being a single dad. It was also about trying to maintain a career in journalism and looking for love, sometimes in the wrong places. And as all of this is going on, I am rescuing and resuscitating our local youth baseball program. And the more I get immersed in the world of baseball through my son, I was first as his coach, where I continued to be his coach and ultimately became the commissioner of this little league, the more that came to feel like, I don't know, the defining moment of my adult life, or at least of my middle years, I was kind of sucked into this world of adult drama, and had my, you know, my judgment and financial acumen and psychological skills and everything tested in ways that I had never really anticipated. And, you know, I didn't pass all of those tests with flying colors. So it ends up being kind of a soap opera. It's like a telenovela set against the backdrop of a children's game.
The challenge to me would be in this project would be of finding the story and sort of defining the parameters of, you know, where certain things leave off, what to include, what, you know, sort of all of the telling details of what contributes to the central story of what you're trying to tell. So talk a little bit about that, about, you know, kind of wrangling this into a definable circle of events, and, you know, if you struggled with what had to be cut out and what was contributing to the story and what maybe wasn't.
Yeah, well, I had a very wise editor at Crown Books in New York who reminded me that there's a difference between an autobiography and a memoir. And, you know, an autobiography is everything that ever happened to you from beginning to end. And a memoir is, you know, is a slice of your life. It's your life viewed through through a certain prism, through a defining event or experience. And I struggled, certainly in the early drafts of this, and perhaps even in the finished product, to make sure that every digression was serving the story. And the story is based, it's not just in Monterey Park, but it's in a park. It's in our park called La Loma, which is this lovely, kind of crazy hillside park concealed from the street, high up above Monterey Park. And you could drive by it, you know, 1,000 times and never know it's up there. It was this kind of like secret universe atop the hill. And so much of the action, both the baseball stuff on the field, but also the kind of the adult intrigue and hijinks takes place in this park. So it's either, you know, on the diamond or behind the baselines. And I step away from that quite a bit at times. There's a moment where I'm sort of examining who I am, where I come from, how is it that I ended up in Monterey Park and adopted this place as my home, and I retrace my mother's flight from Nazi-occupied France during World War II, and I went and followed her footsteps. I hiked over the Pyrenees Mountains from France into Spain, which is a trip she took when she was 6 years old, landing in America, in New York, as a scared little girl speaking French and Russian at the time. And I remember telling my editor that I was going to do this, and he wanted to know exactly how I proposed weaving that into a story about Little League baseball.
Yeah, it is such a great art. I'm wondering how much distance you felt you needed to do this story, if you needed either the distance of time or the physical distance away from the baseball and your child's growing up to sort of see this through, you know, fresh journalistic eyes as opposed to being kind of right down in it. Did you feel like there were times that you could have written the story and times that it would have been too soon to write the story?
Yes, to all of those. Where I write about some of the early, phases of my life and a marriage to my son's mother, who was a Nicaraguan immigrant, and kind of this tumultuous relationship that we had. That was 15, 20 years ago. I was able, I think, to write about that with some degree of perspective. There's other stuff towards the end of the book where another ill-fated and perhaps unwise romance unravels. And I was actually, living through that as I was writing the book. So I had absolutely no perspective on that whatsoever, and some of the early versions of that sounded more pained than wise, I think.
right. My guest this morning is Jesse Katz. The book is The Opposite Field. His memoir is The Opposite Field, and also award-winning journalist. I'm wondering if turning that journalistic eye that you so beautifully have onto yourself revealed things to you that the living through of these experiences could never have revealed to you, but through the writing process and whatever that cathartic event of coming up with the memoir is, revealed things to you that you learned about yourself that the living through it process would not have revealed.
Horrible, horrible things. For much of my life, I've aimed that spotlight on other people and have tried to peek behind their mask and sort of probe their inner workings and try to figure out what makes them tick. And this is really the first time in my life where I aimed that white hot light back on myself. And I would often I'd sit in front of my computer screen every day and try to sift through my life and the rubble sometimes, and then that computer screen ceased being a screen at a certain point and became this mirror, and it was reflecting back to me all these patterns and foibles and shortcomings and yearnings and all kinds of things about myself that maybe I was vaguely aware of, but I had never quite connected the dots. And I think just to go back to your earlier point about perspective, one of the very trickiest parts of writing this book was the balance between creating scenes, being in the moment where I'm a character in that moment, and then stepping out of those scenes and being the narrator. And the difference was, in those moments, Jesse Katz is kind of bumbling, and I like to think well intended, but not always very wise or aware of what he's getting himself into, and I have to be true to those moments and let those kind of play out as authentically as possible, but then I have to be able to step back away from that and wear the hat of Jesse Katz, the narrator, the author of this memoir, and that Jesse Katz has to be a lot wiser and a lot more insightful and introspective than Jesse Katz, the character.
That's that's a really good point. That's a really good point. Note to
that
self, never write
back and forth was always a struggle.
Yeah, right. I think I'll never write a memoir after here. Sounds painful.
Only if you do it right.
Right, exactly. Only if you do it right. I guess the flip side of this also is taking care of your characters who aren't really characters, who are your son and your, you know, your wife and your the other people in the book, and keeping this to, you know, I hear a lot of memoir writers say, you know, whatever his issues were, meaning my husband or my son, that wasn't my story to tell. So I needed to keep this as my story to tell and my version of events. But, you know, in the wake of that, there's often, I suppose, a little bit of collateral damage of, you know, these people getting roped into it. Was that ever on your radar as sort of a concern of how the other people in your life would react to the book and having their story out there as well?
Yeah, well, there were some people I was more concerned about than others. There's a handful of villains in the book, and I think they did not, you know, think kindly of me before I wrote it, and I don't think there was much that I wrote that was going to change that or exacerbate it. I did feel by being brutally honest about myself and revealing some of my own flaws in a kind of frank way, maybe took the sting out of, or I hope took the sting out of, revealing some of. The foibles of people around me, that we were kind of all in this together, and the book wasn't really about settling scores. It wasn't about telling secrets, but it was really being honest, being real about who we are, who we become, what goes on inside us when behind that mask that we present to the public. Yeah. I think that, you know, the relationship that I cared the most about, of course, was my son, Max, who is a young boy throughout most of the story, and is now a 19-year-old young man just back from his freshman year in college. And it was important to me that I went through everything in the story with him before it was finished. I wanted him to know everything that was in there, and I wanted to prepare him for, you know, some of the less than flattering depictions, you know, more of myself than of him or the people around us. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately the book is kind of like his genesis story. It's really sort of a record or a chronicle of the somewhat unusual marriage that produced him and the kind of unlikely contrarian path that we've traveled, you know, as a family, as father and son, and ultimately living, choosing Monterey Park, choosing a predominantly immigrant, predominantly Asian and Latino community to call our home.
Right. My guest this morning is Jesse Katz. The memoir is The Opposite Field. Let's talk a little bit about your research process. Both you've touched on this just slightly with the memoir, but also from a journalistic perspective. The world has changed so much from, you know, what it was when I was a kid and how you approached a research project. And, you know, I love this idea that you actually traveled the roads that your mother traveled in her, you know, in her process. Tell me a little bit about sort of unconventional modes of research that that may have contributed either to the memoir or to some of maybe your more interesting journalistic assignments.
Well, I'm not sure that it's all that exciting or exotic. It really just involves hanging out and being quiet and patient. I'm a real believer in getting close, really being not getting in the story, but getting as close to it as possible, so you have a front row seat to things that are happening, and the ability to observe, and of course the classic writer's advice of showing and not telling. But to be present and and have moments, have scenes that unfold before you, there's no substitute for that. So, you know, I feel like any story that I've ever done or cared deeply about and have had the time to invest has always involved just getting on the inside, you know, gaining access. And there's no formula for that. I'm not sure you can really teach that. When I am at UC Irvine and the literary journalism program, we talk about it a little bit, but it's really kind of the art of human interaction. And you know, some examples. I did a story on taco trucks in East LA that was quite well received, and it won a James Beard Award that I'm enormously proud of. What do you say about a taco truck? I mean, taco trucks are everywhere. It's hardly, you know, stop the presses. There's taco trucks in LA, but we only know them, you know, largely from the outside. We know the image of the taco truck. Maybe we stood at the counter and ordered some carne asada tacos, but the story of the truck is the inside, right? It's the people inside. It's their hopes and dreams and fears and aspirations. And, you know, I chose it. A truck, and you know, worked for weeks to insinuate myself into the life of this family and be present with them on the inside, you know, gaining access to the inner workings of you know, both the machinery of the truck, but of their lives, and this kind of insane proposition of investing everything you have in a kitchen on wheels and drive that around the barrio looking for a corner to call your own. And so anyway, I mean, that's, to me, that's research is just getting on the inside.
I love that. And your ability to extract the telling detail from something and to, just, I mean, your facility with language, and I don't know if you read poetry, but you, the rhythm of your language, you know, the cadence, the way the words sound in your mouth as you're reading them out loud in the memoir, it's well done, very well done. That's another thing. I never know if you can, you know, how far you can go in teaching that, but, you know, if that's more talent as opposed to, I think you can get a ways with it, but your ability to do that is really remarkable.
Well, thank you. I do try to teach or suggest moments for more expansive language. You know, it's like you have to kind of learn the gimmicks and then you have to unlearn them. So I spent 15 years at the LA Times, and to get through daily journalism, you know, you learn a lot of shortcuts, and you learn that kind of, that journalese, that shorthand, so that somebody who wears glasses, you know, is suddenly now bespectacled, you know, which is, you know, just a fake word. And we shouldn't use bespectacled if we can avoid it. And so I, you know, when I left the LA Times and went to LA Magazine and had a chance, I think to slow down the pace of my stories, there was more time to construct them, and then there was more real estate in the magazine to let them unfold. It offered more opportunities for unlearning and undoing some of those journalistic gimmicks and just trying to find authentic language to make moments and images come alive. But if you don't know what the gimmick is, if you don't know what the cliche is, you can't undo it.
Right. Yeah, as you're saying that, it was striking to me, the circle back to the unlearning the legalese, and is so much of writing is unlearning all of the horrible lessons that were drilled into us early on, the five paragraph theme and all of that crap that you have to take out of your brain. But you're right, you have to know the rules first before you know how to break them properly, and that's true. So we're drawing down on our time. I'm wondering if there's any advice to writers that we haven't covered so far that you'd like to share in the end.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I came across a kind of a system of writing. I'm always suspicious of kind of formulas or, you know, 7 easy steps to success in anything. But I came across something written by a former UT Austin professor named Betty Sue Flowers, and she called it the madman architect carpenter judge model. And her idea was that all successful writing follows a certain kind of process, and each one of those characters or archetypes needs time on the stage. And I think too often we kind of jump to the end of the process and we just start writing and we kind of don't know where we're going, or we start worrying about how correct our writing is and we just straitjacket ourselves right out of the gates. And her thought was, is, you know, we all need to kind of take a creative leap and marinate and let some sort of originality or inspiration percolate up. That was the madman or the madwoman. And, you know, whether that happens during, you know, a walk on the beach or meditation or running or whatever, or over a cup of tea or a glass of wine, whatever that may be, you need to step away from your keyboard and your computer screen and allow kind of some free associations to take place.
That's excellent.
And then the architect comes in and tries to, provide some order, make sense of this, organize it in some meaningful way. And only then, once you've got kind of a plan, a sense of what you're trying to say, should the carpenter step in and begin doing that assembly work.
I love that. That's fabulous advice to end on. Jesse Katz, this was an enormous pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marie.
That was Jesse Katz. The memoir is The Opposite Field. It's published by Crown. You can find Jesse at buyjessekatz.com. There's more information about his memoir. He's got a wonderful blog that follows his, if you're ever setting out on a book tour or something, he's got a blog that chronicles some of that. His stories, some of his journalistic work is up there. It's a great website. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Patricia Redmond will be here in the second half hour talking about her latest novel, The Possibility of You. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Look at all the cars, lots of colored cars. Ah, there's a blue one. Isn't it pretty? Ooh, look how fast that red one's going. It's red like that stop sign. Like my jacket.
This is a 38-year-old man
My jacket's not a car, is it? Is my jacket a car? My jacket is red, but it doesn't go fast.
He may sound a little strange to you and me.
Vroom. Vroom, vroom.
But to his 2-year-old son, who's interested in cars and colors, he makes perfect sense.
That's the sound cars make.
When you talk with your child, you build vocabulary, and learning starts long before school does. So follow their lead. Take simple everyday moments, like eating dinner or just watching cars go by, and turn them into learning moments.
Ooh, look, red car!
Yes! And it's moving awfully fast.
Blue car!
Yes! The man in the red car is about to meet the man in the blue car. Get himself a pretty pink ticket.
Turn everyday moments into learning moments. For more tips, go to bornlearning.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Life can be frustrating. Good thing doing your taxes doesn't have to be. With eFile from the IRS, you can do your federal taxes online, with tax software, or even through your tax preparer. It's quick and easy, and you'll get that refund fast, in as little as 10 days with direct deposit. Ready to find out more? Get the eFile story at irs.gov. Because life can be frustrating enough.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We have an amazing speaker series event coming up next Tuesday night. And if you are in town, if you're in the Orange County area, I think we have a couple of seats left, but you should go onto Barbara's website, check that out. Those are always incredibly lovely events. This time, I believe we have two or three authors joining us, so check us out there. Again, I'm your host, Marie Stone. I'm joined now by Pamela Redmond. Pamela, along with Linda Rosenkrantz, are the preeminent experts in baby names featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Today Show. They're regular contributors to Parents, the Huffington Post, and the Daily Beast. In addition, Pamela is a New York Times bestselling author who's written 18 books and is a columnist for Glamour. Her latest novel is The Possibility of You. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's driving much of our discussion this morning. Pamela, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on, especially in this last minute rush here of trying to get you. I apologize for that. So I have to ask first about the baby name revolution and how that came about. I love that women named Pamela and Linda are the revolutionizers of these baby names.
I know, as our names are sailing off to sea, but you know, that happens every generation. We have a 4-generation rule, and I think it takes 4 generations for a name to sound cool and maybe appropriate again.
I love that. So what led you into, I think I read someplace that you had a very early interest in baby names, you know, kind of from childhood, but tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was what I now know is called a name nerd. And on Nameberry, which is the site that Linda and I own, we have whole boards of teenage name nerds. But there wasn't a name for it in the pre-internet days when we all labored in isolation thinking we were just plain old weirdos. But Linda and I both had this interest from childhood in names, and we were both writers and friends. So names were just something we talked about, and that's what led us to write our first book, which was called Beyond Jennifer and Jason.
That's great.
And it was looking at names in a different way than anyone had looked at them before.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So let's, there's so much to talk about with the novel. Let's dive into that, the possibility of you. I'll let you sort of introduce it and talk about the genesis of it in your own mind, why you decided or how you sort of came to these characters in this world.
The Possibility of You is the story of three women at three key moments of the past century, and one of the common threads between them is that they're all dealing with unplanned pregnancies. Bridget is an Irish nanny in 1916, kind of the last year of the old world in New York, who visits Margaret Sanger's first birth control clinic in the U.S. I won't tell people what happens when she visits there, but the law is not on her side, let's put it that way. The second character is Billy, who is a young woman in 1976 New York. And by 1976, of course, birth control was legal. Abortion had just become legal. It was a liberated new world, and yet in another way, perhaps it wasn't so liberated. And Kate is a modern character who is a journalist. She's in her late 30s. She has no desire to have children or settle down, partly because she was adopted herself and has really kept her own feelings about her parentage and her identity at bay all these years. And when she finds herself unexpectedly pregnant, she has this drive, as a lot of women do, who are adoptees, to find her birth mother.
Yeah.
So that's the basic foundation of the story.
Tell me how these women were. Was it the women who came to you? Was it the idea of exploring, you know, abortion, adoption, some of these issues that women grapple with? Was it an idea? Was it people? Tell me a little bit about how the story germinated in your head.
The beginning of the story for me was the Bridget character, who is the nanny in 1916. One Sunday, I went onto the Ellis Island website. I think it had just started. I probably read about it in the Times. And I typed in my grandmother's name, and her name really was Bridget. And I saw the date that she arrived in the U.S., May 1st, 1911, her age at the time, which was 23. And it was the same age my own daughter, who had just moved to France and was making her way in this new world by herself, was at that time. And so suddenly I became very curious about my grandmother's life as a young woman far from home, trying to find her way in the world. So my initial idea was really to write this as a purely historical novel. But what I uncovered about the history of that time, particularly the history of women at that time, really led me to see it as something that reverberated over the generations and the decades, and it's still very much alive today.
Tell me a little bit about getting into these, accessing these characters, creating such different, I know the time period that these women lived in was different, which would contribute to who they were and kind of the context in which they're growing up, but sort of the character work that you did to uncover and discover who these women were, how you brought them from, you know, flat character names into these fully realized and complicated, beautiful women that all three of them were. I know some writers talk about keeping journals of their characters or scrapbooks of their characters. Some, you know, have very clear mental images in their minds, either based on people they know in the world or, you know, they cut pictures out of magazines, something like that. Tell me a little bit about your character process.
For me, it starts with the characters. So creating the characters is the first thing that I do before I have any idea what the story is going to be, where the plot's going to go. And that's a technique I learned from a writer who's out there in Southern California, Elizabeth George, who writes British mysteries and who I took a class with many years ago and who is just a wonderful teacher and a wonderful writer. But, you know, approaching especially the characters of Bridget and Maud in 1916, who obviously were living in this different time, in this very different culture, was really challenging because I didn't necessarily know, just on a gut level, how they would think, even how they would dress, how they would feel, how they would talk. For Maud, who is the ex-Ziegfeld Follies girl that Bridget works for, I have this model that I got from this wonderful illustrated biography called Century Girl about Doris Eaton, who is, I don't know if she's still alive, but at the time this biography was done, she was something like 106 and still dancing. And she was great. This, you know, life force person that was on Broadway from the time she was about 14 years old, lying about her age. And I sort of saw Maude as a somewhat more evil version of that. Bridget was difficult because there is not much written, talked about women who were servants 100 years ago. I went to Ellis Island and listened to oral histories there of young Irish women who worked as servants, and they said pretty much what my grandmother would always say, which is, you know, why do you want to know about that? We worked hard, you know, we got out, and it's boring and stupid, and we want to forget about it as quickly as possible. So they certainly weren't writing their journals or their memoirs, and it was very difficult to get inside the character in a way that felt historically authentic. And so I really had to approach her in the same kind of gut way that I would approach, you know, any character, including a contemporary one.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing, this show is aimed at a lot of writers, so they're going to appreciate this story that I heard about with the writing of this book, which is that you wrote it sort of all the way through with the shifting points of view, and then you took each character and just wrote their arc all the way through individually a couple of times, and then the interweaving. So tell us about that. Tell us about that fun process.
Yeah. Wow, it's such a pleasure to talk about these, you know, process and technical things in such detail. You know, the final draft of the book, the draft that basically people read now, if they pick up Possibility of You, was really, the structure was really inspired by Michael Cunningham's The Hours, which, of course, is such a masterwork. And I was at Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, which is a writer and artist colony. And I literally, you know, diagrammed that book, had index cards posted up all over my wall, different color index cards for the different time periods and viewpoints. Once I had the whole structure of my book worked out, then I did write it from beginning to end. And it ships with three different Bridget, Billy, and Kate, the contemporary characters' viewpoints. But at some point toward the end of the book, you get Bridget's viewpoint not only in 1916, but you're getting her viewpoint in 1976, and then you're getting Billy's viewpoint in the present day. So there's some, you know, fancy footwork going on there that was more complex than a straight shifting point of view, shifting time period. My friend Christina Baker Klein, who is a wonderful novelist, had the idea that I should then take the Bridget thread and write that from beginning to end, and the Billy thread and write that from beginning to end, to make each of, as you say, the character arcs and the voices and where those sections begin and end, to make sure that really held together, even though people weren't going to read it that way. It made the book deeper and stronger, I think, in that those voices and those sections were more consistent.
And in fact, I did read the book that way at times. You know, I did go through and see, you know, does the voice hold? I mean, I knew it would because, you know, you're you, so I knew it would. But just to, you know, from a writerly perspective, to see how that goes, you know, yeah, it's I as painful as, yeah, or as long as it may have taken, I don't know if it was painful, but I think that really is a worthwhile process for somebody who is dealing with multiple characters, multiple viewpoints. Did you ever play with doing it in first person? Because it was funny, as I was reading it, I often heard it to myself in first person and then was kind of surprised anew that, you know, that we were in close third person.
Which did you think of of each character in first person?
Mostly Bridget. Yeah, mostly Bridget I kept seeing in first person. But, yeah, I guess all of them. You know, I mean, I felt so close to all three of these women that I could have imagined any of them written in first person. But I was wondering if that was anything you ever played around with.
Well, it's interesting because for most of the process, until, you know, really the last year when I was just doing this structure, the book was written in first person from Billy's point of view, believe it or not. And it was, and that felt very natural to me, but it was a very tricky structure that I think felt less natural for the reader. And it was Billy saying, when I was 19, this thing happened to me, and let me tell you about it. And so she was talking from the present day about her past, and then she would go into Bridget's story, which was told in the third person. And so there was this kind of tricky, you know, one of my favorite books, which is Wuthering Heights, is kind of done with this tricky point of view where there's a story, a first-person storyteller who then goes, or maybe he's third person, but then it shifts to even a further backstory. And then Bridget told me this story, and then it would shift to third person, close into Bridget's point of view. But it was just a little too tricky for most people.
Right, right.
Even though I loved writing it that way, I think that it didn't work as well for the reader, and I'm sure that all your listeners who are novelists will have had a similar experience.
Right, right. Yeah, I, there's so much, there's just so much I appreciated about this book. Tell me a little bit more about your research process. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but were there other unconventional things that you sort of had to do to mine through this? And I know with all of the laws that were going on with abortion, birth control, all of that would be one place where you'd really have to dig in. Were there other things that you learned in the process of this, either through book research or with talking with women? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I was at a book group last night, and the women in the book group were asking me about the research I'd done, and they seemed really, they weren't writers, and they seemed really confused and fascinated by the fact that I couldn't have done it all online. But in fact, you know, there's so much that doesn't really exist online. For instance, Beatrice Hinkle, who was one of the first women psychoanalysts in the United States and the world, a medical doctor, analyzed herself by Jung, translated Jung into English, and in the final version of the book, she has a relatively minor role, but there's very little about her that you can find online. And I happened to be talking at a big party one night about how fascinated I was by her and how frustrating it was not to be able to find anything about her. And someone overheard the conversation and said, there's a psychiatric library in the depths, and it really truly was, or, you know, in this windowless room, you know, in some obscure tower of New York Hospital, and they will have, if anyone has her writing, they will have it. And in fact, they did. They had, you know, her own, every journal she had ever written in, but you can't find the, you know, 1917 New York Journal of New York Psychiatry. It just doesn't exist online because not very many people are really interested in it. So something that was really influential for me was looking at pictures taken during the period at New York Historical Society and at also a CUNY library in New York. And it wasn't, you know, a lot of the pictures from that era are very posed pictures, usually of rich people for obvious reasons or of, you know, very fancy rooms. But the best pictures were these pictures I found that the New York City had taken to create the subway stops on certain street corners. And the guy who was taking the pictures, all he cared about was the street corner. And so he wasn't looking at how people were dressed or what they were doing in the background. And those pictures felt so real and so vivid. because there were, you know, old people, fat people, kids, you know, people not posing for the camera.
Right. Life being lived as it was in a real way instead of, I always say that when people say, you know, your life looks so fun on Facebook. I'm like, everybody's life looks fun on Facebook. That's the point. That's how we design it. But that's not real life, you know. That's funny. That's funny.
Right. Right. But in 1916, the world was designed. Books and movies, even what passed for art at that time, was very artificial. And so very sentimentalized.
Yeah, right. Were there things we're drawing down on our time, but were there things in the writing of this book that somehow changed your mind about how you saw the past, how you saw some of these reproductive issues for women? Was the writing of this sort of transformative for you in a way, either as writer or as woman?
It very much felt to me like I cannot believe these same battles are being fought again and again and again. And in 1916, 100 years ago, birth control was illegal, but rich women had free access to birth control, effective birth control, as well as abortions, and poor women did not. And it was poor women who were having babies for all kinds of reasons, that they didn't want and couldn't support. And I think somehow this is a situation that's still going on in a way that you would think would be more different a century later.
Yeah. It's amazing how much that topic comes up, whether it's in reproductive rights or in wars or in, racial issues or whatever, that you just can't believe that the same discussions are being had and that we don't make any more progress than we do. But there it is.
And racism and economic and disparity and sexism all play such a role, religion. So it's complicated and not necessarily any less complicated as we get theoretically more advanced.
right. Isn't that true? Pamela Redmond, this was an enormous pleasure this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you. What a wonderful show.
Fun. That was Pamela Redmond. The book is The Possibility of You. It is out. It is published by Simon & Schuster. It's a fantastic, fantastic read on three generations of women all struggling with reproductive issues. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., as we always are. You've been tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Girl, when I saw you and that girl walking.